The political underdog in the Jacksonville mayor's race says he's gaining momentum, and he'll take your calls this morning. Good morning, and hope you're staying warm out there. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect, always live on the radio. And now, if you miss a show, never fear. Our podcast is here. Catch our daily podcasts every day on iTunes. Just ahead, it's your chance to connect with mayoral candidate Bill Bishop. You can get on the line right now at 549-2937. Then later, a special ceremony this weekend in St. Augustine commemorating those who experienced the Middle Passage. Plus, the economic lessons hidden inside The Simpsons. Yeah, that'll be later in the hour. All of that ahead. But first this morning, he is the political underdog in the Jacksonville mayor's race, but City Councilman Bill Bishop says he's in it to win it. And he started to draw some endorsements from local Republicans and also is working to build a diverse coalition as he seeks to make the runoff in the March unitary election here in Jacksonville. That contest, of course, will also feature incumbent Mayor Alvin Brown and GOP challenger Lenny Curry. Now, Bishop is the only candidate in the race who's actually been willing to get specific on a number of sensitive topics and issues, such as whether to update the city's human rights ordinance, taxes and spending, and so forth. And he'll vie for votes at this weekend's Hobnob and Straw Poll, sponsored by the First Coast Tea Party, one of several on the calendar. This morning, he's in studio and taking your calls. Bill Bishop, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on the program. And right now, here's our question to callers. What are your questions for Jacksonville mayoral candidate Bill Bishop? Get on the line right now. The number to join the show, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. You can email and tweet the show. We also welcome your comments on our Facebook page. Lots to discuss, Bill Bishop. First off, there is a Hobnob event and a straw poll coming up this Saturday, one of several coming up this spring. This one is sponsored by the First Coast Tea Party. You're going to make a push at this event, yes?
Oh, absolutely. We'll attend that, and we'll attend all of them. It's another avenue to present ourselves to potential voters and get our message out to the citizens of Jacksonville.
Let's talk about your message. There's been a lot of discussion about the other two candidates in the race, incumbent Mayor Alvin Brown and former GOP State Party Chair Lenny Curry. They've each raised about $2 million apiece, heavy campaign war chests. You don't have that kind of fundraising, so you're relying on a grassroots campaign, drawing support from Republicans, Democrats, and independents. What's your strategy as you and Curry fight to get into the runoff? The March unitary election, of course, will then let the two top vote getters go ahead to May. How do you see yourself making it through that scrum and getting into the runoff, knocking off your opponent, Lenny Curry, who's better funded?
Well, it's a multi-phase strategy, I suppose. One of the things that I have going for me is that I've been on city council for 8 years, and I have a constituency with a significant number of voters in the city. Through my work and the positions that I've taken and the things that I believe throughout my career, I have constituency in other parts of the city as well that know me. And partly I also believe that the best way to get your message out is to answer questions. Be specific about what you believe. Be specific about what you do. And so far, that's becoming a differentiator in this race because my opponents don't seem to want to do that. And I just believe that people want to hear straight answers, and they appreciate that when it's done. And I think that will resonate.
It's 549-2937. Calls already coming in for mayoral candidate Bill Bishop. Give us a call with your questions on any number of issues, whether it's whether to update the city's human rights ordinance, specifically how you would handle taxation in Jacksonville. And you said the other day at a meeting of the Mennonette Club, you believe a sales tax might be necessary to address the city's pension problems. You've been willing to get very specific on these hot button issues. Why do you think your opponents have been much more vague?
I suppose either because that's the political environment in which they've been consulted to do, just don't take positions on anything, and that way you don't make anybody mad. But the other side of that is you don't tell anybody anything either. That's the only way I know how to do it is to be specific, because at the end of the day, you have to do something. And if you can't do what you say you're going to do, what's the point? And that's just simply the only way I know how to do it.
You're a Republican, but you've taken positions that have appealed to some moderates and liberals, in particular your endorsement of updating the city's human rights ordinance. How do you see your support coalescing in a part of the state that's still fairly conservative on social issues?
Well, I do it from the standpoint that I look at it from the fundamental founding of what our country is all about, which is all people are created equal, and that we should be, I mean, this isn't a liberal, conservative, whatever you want to call it, issue. It is simply an issue of what's right, and that we should be long past the point in our history where we discriminate against somebody because of who or what they are. We're not talking about behavior. We're not talking about issues that are not impacted at a local level. We're talking about how you treat people as individuals. And we are a country of individuals and of individual rights. And so I look at it from that perspective.
549-2937, and we'll go to your calls in just a moment, for mayoral candidate Bill Bishop. Why, in your view, are you a better candidate to lead this city than current Mayor Alvin Brown or former state party chair and business owner Lenny Curry?
Well, in a number of reasons. I mean, Alvin's record will stand on its own, and Lenny's as well. I look at it from my perspective. I am the most experienced person running in this race. From a business standpoint, I've been in business. I've run a business for almost 25 years. I know what that means. I know what it means to make a payroll. I know what it means to have people's livelihoods depending on actions that I take. I've been on the council for 8 years almost now, and I know how the city works. I've been council president. I know how the mechanics of the government structure works. I know what works reasonably well, and I know what doesn't work well. And so I have ideas on how to fix things. And I'm very passionate about this history of the city. I'm very passionate about where it's going. I understand what our assets are. I understand where our challenges are. And I believe I have the ability to articulate a vision for the city and provide the leadership to get it done.
Can a moderate Republican make the runoff? For example, in 2011, moderate Republicans and Democrats coalesced behind Audrey Moran. In the end, though, she did not make it to the runoff. The conservative Republican Mike Hogan did. How do you hope to avoid a replay of that dynamic this time around?
I suspect that the reason that Mike got in the runoff as opposed to Audrey in that particular case had to do more about what happened on the campaign between Audrey Moran and Rick Mulaney. And people just did not take well to how those two went at each other. I think if you ask them, they would probably tell you the same thing at this point, not trying to put words in their mouths. But I mean, my approach here is not to bash somebody, but to tell people what I want to do. I mean, that's the right and proper way to do it. You have to be able to stand on your record. You have to be able to tell people what you're going to do. And that's basically how I plan to run this campaign.
And I'm curious to ask you this as well. When it comes to intra-party politics and the local GOP leadership, many of them endorsing Lenny Curry, have you been privately encouraged to step aside? The old saying is, you know, Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. You have not fallen in line. You are standing firm and continuing to run an aggressive campaign.
Well, it's funny. That's the old adage, if you will. But I will tell you that, sure, there were overtures asking me, do I really know what I'm doing? And do I really want to do this, et cetera, et cetera? But
who said that to you?
Well, I won't get into that. But it was probably the softest attempt that I've ever, firstly, it's the only one I've ever experienced, but it's of what I've heard in the past. It was really a half-hearted at best effort. So I would say that there really wasn't any major attempt to try to get me to step down.
No strong arm tactics, nothing like that.
No, not at all.
And if you're just joining the show right now, we're speaking with City Councilman and mayoral candidate Bill Bishop. What are your questions about the mayor's race and what are your questions for the candidate? 549-2937 is the number to join the show. Susie in Mandarin. Go ahead, Susie.
Wow, I am totally blown out, excited about the opportunity we have to have a leader with the guts to say what's right and the experience to bring it. So I'm really behind you. I can't wait to find out how to get some yard lines. And I really just got introduced to you through that Folio article a couple weeks back, but I was really, you know, okay, so my questions are, let's say you're on a plane, I don't know where, but, you know, you're talking to the guy next to you, and he asks, what do you do? What would you tell him about what is the best and the worst about Jacksonville that you'd like to get involved in and make a change? So thanks for being there this morning. This is great.
That's Susie in Mandarin. Thanks for the call, Susie. So if you're elected mayor, what would be your top priorities? That's a good question from that listener.
Well, Susie, that is a great question. From the standpoint of talking to somebody on the plane about it, I mean, I could talk for hours about what's great about Jacksonville. And I can even talk about what our problems are. In a sense, I don't look at them so much as they are problems, but they're challenges. They're just simply things that we need to fix. And as far as priorities, Melissa, you're asking about what priorities are number one. Obviously, the single most important issue that this city has to solve is our pension problem, our unfunded pension liability, because that one issue is sucking all the oxygen out of the room here. It's the condition that we're living with that is keeping us from doing anything else. It doesn't have to, but it is, because it consumes so much of our tax resources. And until we get that under control, until we find a way to get the payment into the system under control, we can't have an intelligent conversation about what is our proper level of taxation as a community. What do we want it to be? What do we want our city government to provide? And so that is job number one. That has to get fixed immediately. And unfortunately, it's looking more and more like it's still going to be there after the next election.
You don't believe the plan that's on the table is a viable one that would involve JEA's participation?
No, for many reasons, I don't think that it's not a viable opportunity.
You don't think the council
solution.
Will approve it?
Well, no, not in the short term, I don't, because the portion, if you take the JEA piece in a vacuum, all of the various components of that proposal for JEA are good in and of themselves in a vacuum. Anything that helps our utility company, which we own, by the way, just people need to understand, we own JEA. Helping get their costs under control is good for the city in the long run, because we are an electrically dependent economy. And anything we can do to keep electric rates down is A, good for the consumer, and B, it's good for business, because that's how business uses power. And especially if we want to grow manufacturing. Manufacturing in Jacksonville uses a lot of electricity, and we are at a cost disadvantage when we have high rates. And so that part's good. The city side is not so good, because we don't have... JEA has the ability to borrow $120 million by using future savings. It's identified that they don't pay the city general fund. So in that sense, that borrowing becomes basically cost neutral. The city side, we don't have that same opportunity. We're basically relying on future growth to pay for that. If we're talking about it not so supposedly not being a tax increase to pay for it, we're talking about pay for it by future growth. And the economy is not growing at the rate needed to pay that back. And so that will put an additional stress on the general fund.
And so your solution, which you mentioned at the Mennonette Club, you think putting a half-cent sales tax on the ballot to handle pension issues is the way to go.
Well, that is one of a couple of ways to go. I think that is probably the best of the few that we have. Suffice it to say, at the end of the day, because of the high level of debt that we have in the pension system, it is going to take more revenue to pay for it. And the only way we have that is through taxation of some sort. That's the only way cities get money. And the challenge, I like the sales tax model, because I think it is a much broader base than a property tax is, because it also captures revenue from people who either pass through or work here but don't live here. But while they work here, they are still consuming our services, police and fire protection and all of that. They're still benefiting from that. So I think it's appropriate that cost sharing be done on a more general basis. That is harder to do because we have to get the permission of the legislature to let us do it.
Yeah, and lots of calls, meanwhile, if you're just tuning in, for Jacksonville mayoral candidate Bill Bishop. We'll go to your emails, tweets, and Facebook comments in a moment. The number to join the show by phone, 549-2937. Mark on the west side. Go ahead, Mark.
Good morning. Mr. Bishop, this is a hypothetical question, but it's probably about 100% certain that it will happen at some point during your reign. But Shad Khan says he wants a new stadium complex. And if history is our guide, it's going to cost $400 or $500 million. And he wants us to pay that money, or he's going to take the Jaguars and leave. What are you going to do?
Well, thanks, Mark. First of all, it'll probably cost close to $1 billion in today's market in the NFL world. The cost escalation is getting tremendously high in that world. I would suggest that if that were to happen in the next 4 years, the answer is going to be no. Sorry, we don't have the money to do it. And they're really all the wishful thinking in the world is not going to generate $1 billion out of this city, especially when we're trying to pay off pensions, we're trying to find money for port expansion. That just won't work.
John on the South Side. Hey, John, thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Melissa, thank you for taking my call. And I've got my Mayor Bishop yard sign right in the front yard. Councilman Bishop, right now there's active legislation before the council, 2014-560, the CRADIA plan. And under the CRA, Community Redevelopment Area, we are currently expanding the entertainment district. Under the CRA, there's going to be 4.8 miles of the river boundary from the Fuller Lawn to the Matthews Bridge. Under your leadership, would you consider immediately opening up the river in all these new docks, piers, and kayak launches for economic opportunity immediately? And that's my question.
All right, John, thanks for the call.
Thanks, John. I know where you're going with this. And the short conceptual answer is there's nothing wrong with opening up the riverfront to commercial activity. That's what we do here. And I think there is a model, and you and I have talked about this, there is a model out there whereby what you're trying to accomplish, I think, can be done. I don't think that I personally know enough about the economics of river taxis and water taxis yet, or the safety implications of how you regulate that sort of an activity, but I think it can be done, and I don't think it's all that difficult to do. So yes, in general, I support what you're trying to do.
549-2937, Marie is on the line. Marie, go ahead.
Oh, yes. Being Florida is the Sunshine State, will you work to overcome the strictest laws in the country we have here to develop much needed solar energy, which will help us avoid a destructive future for our young people? The worst fear being Florida being underwater. There's so many reasons. I mean, we are the Sunshine State. Okay. Please tell us what you can do for that.
All righty. Thanks for that question.
Great question, Maria. We are the Sunshine State. However, it is a misnomer. We are not necessarily the best state or the best region to capitalize on solar energy. The actual amount of sunshine that we get is quite low. You'd be surprised at it. But that being said, we have an awful lot of rooftop area that can be used for solar energy, and I do believe that it is appropriate to do that. And I certainly want to work with JEA to change their regulations and their methodology for buying solar power back from people.
Yeah, there's this push to let third parties buy and sell the units of solar. What do you think about that?
I think the marketplace is wide open for that sort of thing. At one of the recent JEA board meetings that I attend, because I'm the council liaison to JEA, we talked about that. They don't really have a policy. They're very much behind the power curve on solar energy, and they know it. And they have a big problem with that, because basically right now they've almost actively discouraged people from doing it, which is bad, because it is a very viable option. They also have a policy where they don't really have a policy on what they do with people that want to connect into the grid. What needs to happen is they need to make that more user-friendly, and they need to see that as a potential source of power for them as well, and generate the methodology to buy power more so at the wholesale rate than what they're doing right now is at the retail rate, which isn't sustainable either. But I think they need to do more of promoting that activity as opposed to discouraging it, because the market is going to do it anyway.
Lots of Facebook comments for Bill Bishop. Paula writes, I would have sworn that I'd write in one of my cats than a Republican for mayor, but this guy comes through is so open and honest, I will have to vote for him. Carlos, I'm just tuning in, but I'd like to ask him his vision for downtown and having an entertainment district in the area and what to do about dredging the river.
Well, number one, downtown is a huge priority of mine. It's been a huge priority for many, many years, even before going back to council. Downtowns are the face that we show the world of what we think of our city. And right now, if we were a disinterested third party coming here, you'd think we don't really care much about our city because our downtown really isn't much. It has huge potential that we can realize very quickly. I believe that, and I want to see that happen. As far as dredging the river is concerned, that is a really, really big topic. We must make sure that our port is competitive in the world market because it is a big economic driver. I think the jury's still open at this point as to whether we actually can or should dredge it, and is it economically viable. A lot of it has to do with the environmental health of it. The whole Rodman Dam, Ocklawaha River restoration is a big piece of it. In my view, if we cannot get that done as a part of it, we shouldn't dredge it. The ecological implications are just too serious, and I still think that the port can be economically viable without it. If we can get the Rodman removed and the river restored, then if the economics support it, then I think we should pursue it. The challenge is going to be we have to find our own $300 million of our local money to match the federal and state dollars.
That's another tax.
It's another tax structure. We got to find a way to pay for it.
Lots of tweets for Bill Bishop. In the past, Bishop has supported pedestrian, bike, multimodal efforts. How would you further those as mayor?
Well, that becomes a high priority from a planning standpoint. Mayor Charlie Latham at the beach and I were successful in getting a bicycle pedestrian corridor study from the beaches to downtown in the current TPO long range plan. I want to partner with all of the various agencies around to get that done. There's strength in numbers. The nice thing about bicycle and pedestrian access systems is they're relatively low cost. It doesn't cost a whole lot to build a sidewalk, and it doesn't cost a whole lot to build bike lanes. And I think we can do a lot more of that than we are. We just need to make sure that we get a plan in place to do it, and that's job number one.
Here's a tweet from Joel. What are your thoughts on Uber entering the market and violating city regulations?
That's
the ride-sharing service.
I'm very familiar with Uber. I supported the bill that got them here in the first place when they came out and said that we're just going to do black car service and we're not going to do UberX, and then they turned around and did it anyway. I think Uber's learning some hard lessons around the world that they just can't do that. At the end of the day, the system is a good idea. I think taxi companies are learning that a mobile app is the way to go. We do not have a taxi market in Jacksonville in the traditional sense that you see in New York or Chicago or other places. The only place we have that is at the airport and maybe the Omni Hotel downtown. Every other place you get a taxi, it's no different than any other call-up on-demand ride service. You have to call them up and wait for the car. And so the whole Uber and Lyft model is going to and is revolutionizing the transportation industry. And I don't think it's going to be all that tough to get them on the same page of some of the basic public safety rules that we need to do.
Jay tweets the show, how will you work to improve underserved communities on the north and east sides of Jacksonville?
There's a number of things that we can do and I want to see done. We have a pot of money in the city called the Northwest Jacksonville Economic Development Trust Fund that has kind of languished over the last few years. It's been around since Mayor Godbold's days. To a greater or lesser degree of success. That is a pot of money that we can use as seed money to any number of things. Number one is partner with our education entities, the school board, FSCJ, the private for-profit educational entities of all sorts, to bring education to underserved neighborhoods because education directly leads to job opportunities. We want to work with JTA to make sure that we have transportation in those areas because initially when it's going to take time to get businesses to go there. But the first thing we want to do is get people educated and employed. And so we have to get them to jobs. And then in the meantime, we can use that economic fund to use it as an attractant, as an incentive package potentially to get businesses to move there. There are a number of business types that can do very well in that part of the city. And we need to make the same type of push to move businesses there that we have done historically in the southern part of the city. Use that same motivation.
And here's an interesting email from Ann in Mandarin. What is Bill Bishop's position on a dedicated library taxing district? I was disappointed that effort failed in November. Getting all kinds of questions.
Oh, this is good stuff today. But basically, I'm not a fan of the idea of having to do it, but historically we have underfunded our library for many, many years. The library system is our single biggest education asset that the city directly controls. It is a huge public resource that must be maintained. And from that standpoint, I do support a dedicated funding source for it because it's too important not to do it.
Would you support a taxing district for UF Health? The Jacksonville Civic Council may be floating that proposal very soon. That's our safety net hospital for the city.
Right. That's another one that is probably, I don't know, it's too soon to say whether I support or don't support a taxing authority. But other counties have done that, and at some level that may be necessary because we have habitually underfunded CHANS. I keep wanting to call it CHANS, called CHANS
right,
forever, but
right,
UF Health.
Right.
That is the only level one trauma center in the entire region, and we need to make sure it stays open.
Let's go to Bruce. He's on the line from the north side. Hi, Bruce. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Doing great, thanks.
Good. I had a question about your position on this issue with the pension. Maybe you've already answered it, but my question is, when is there going to be a unified effort to resist this waste of the firemen and the police union? I respect law enforcement, and I'm all for the firemen and what they do, but we're getting older as a city, and we simply cannot afford to pay this pension. And for someone to think that you can raise taxes to pay someone else's pension, I think that's unrealistic. And when the mayor's office, the city council, even the governor, I say kudos to this lady, Representative Atkins, for trying to do what she's trying to do, although she was denied by the governor. But when is this going to stop? Because we have to take note what happened in Detroit, of the waste there, and they ended up bankrupt. We simply can't afford to pay these people's pension.
Yeah.
Put them on the 401k like everyone else, and go from there.
And that's Bruce on the north side. Hey, Bruce, thank you for that call. You have a similar question from Bert. He emailed the show. Since Governor Scott has punted on the review of the police and fire pension fund actions and stewardship, what is happening with your effort to define the legality of the 30-year police and fire pension fund? So we're back where we started. Why don't we, I guess, close with your final thoughts on the city's pension dilemma?
The city's pension dilemma is a complicated one that we don't have time to get into, but basically under the short version is, as unfortunate as it is, the caller was correct. We can't afford it anymore. But under Florida law, short of filing bankruptcy for the city, most of that debt has to be paid because it's accrued benefits that we can't get out of. We can, however, change everything prospectively. And the challenge here is we need to get a benefit structure that's comparable with the marketplace. Right now, our structure is too far ahead of the marketplace, and we simply can't afford it. We have to get commensurate with the marketplace. We must do that, or we're not going to be able to hire good people and keep them here. But by the same token, the caller's right. We're asking our taxpayers to pay for something that they will never, ever see in their lifetime, anything remotely close to it. And from that perspective, the people that receive these pensions have to understand where the money comes from, and they have to participate in the solution.
You'll be at the straw poll and Hobnob this Saturday, and I believe there's also a rally for your campaign this weekend. Is that right?
That's right. 3:00 Sunday at Memorial Park.
Bill Bishop, running for mayor, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And later in the hour, here's something for you. Getting rich by watching The Simpsons? One noted researcher has some clues about that, and she'll join the show. It's a preview of her talk at FSCJ. But up next, marking those who died and also those who survived the horrific Middle Passage. We'll tell you about a special ceremony this weekend in St. Augustine. You're listening to First Coast Connect. Back in a moment.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Alice Fuja,
Ari Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
It doesn't get a lot of credit in the parenting world, but the ability to place things in categories is crucial to survival.
Look at their clock. What's that? Coffee pot. What do I do with it?
But sometimes, this impulse to categorize the world around you can make you do remarkably strange things. The Power of Categories on the next Invisibilia.
From NPR.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And we're the guys from Deemable Tech.
Hey, if you've got a question about your computer, mobile phone, tablet, or the internet...
And who doesn't?
We're here to help.
Join us Thursdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WJCT.
And check out our podcast online at deemable.com.
That's deemable.com.
Heroin addiction and fatal overdoses are increasing in the U.S., but investigative reporter Jason Cherkis says most rehab programs are ignoring effective new treatments. On the next Fresh Air, Cherkis talks about his series, Dying to Be Free, published in the Huffington Post. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Looking for something different musically? Listen to After Hours weeknights at 7 on 89.9 FM. From classical to country, only on 89.9 FM. Your community, your world, your music.
If you're traveling to the north...
Welcome back. Well, it was known as the Middle Passage, the second stage of the triangular trade between Europe, Africa, and the New World, in which millions were kidnapped and shipped to America as part of the Atlantic slave trade. Now, in 2011, a new project was established to honor and commemorate the 2 million captive Africans who died during the Middle Passage and the 500,000 who survived but were enslaved. They all arrived at 41 documented sites in the U.S. up and down the eastern seaboard, including several spots right here in our area. And at those arrival spots, a significant story in American history began. This Saturday in St. Augustine, there's going to be a special event, the unveiling of an historic marker to commemorate the slaves who were brought to the nation's oldest city. Ann Chin is executive director of the Middle Passage Ceremonies and Port Markers Project. She joins us now in studio with more. Also, Ann Cobb, a board member with the project. Two Anns in studio. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Ann Chin, let's begin with you. You've been involved with the Middle Passage Ceremony and Port Markers Project for some time. There was certainly a need for it because there was nothing to commemorate this momentous historical event that happened. In fact, a couple of people here at WJCT, smart, educated people, came up to me and said, "What is this Middle Passage?" They didn't even know what the Middle Passage meant. This shows the need for this, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that there's a question we say, why the Middle Passage? I mean, why focus upon that? Well, not only was the journey horrible, and it involves, of course, the slave trade, you know, making people, human beings, into commodities. It also populated the Western Hemisphere. It is the journey that marks the transition from being African in the sense of having a home and an identity and crossing an ocean under horrific conditions, nothing compared to it, and arriving at different areas in the Western Hemisphere. It is the beginning of what I say would be the African-American experience in the hemisphere.
Yeah. And, so and as you pointed out, many died, some did not, some survived.
There's sort of a breakdown. There are about 24 million Africans over a period of almost 500 years removed from their homelands, victims of war, greed, rivalries, that they came to the coast, east and west coast. So that's 24 million. Of that portion, half died in the journeys to the coast. Then you would have 12 million people who would go onto these ships. And in that journey, 2 million died over the period of 500 years. So 10 million people arrived in the Western Hemisphere, only 500,000 in what became the United States. So that those are pretty much the ancestors. And those are the people, those who died in 2 million. And the 500,000 specific to the mainland. But in the Western Hemisphere, there was a lot of transfer of people back and forth.
Sure. So Ann Cobb, St. Augustine, known as the nation's oldest city, right there in the downtown historic area, there's an old slave market that still stands. This will be a completely different marker or memorial. Can you give us a preview of what's going to be happening Saturday in St. Augustine?
Well, there will be two events to happen in St. Augustine. The first is at 12 noon at the Castillo de San Marcos, and that will be a remembrance ceremony that will include representatives of the diverse faith groups. There'll be a libation, drumming, song to just celebrate, honor, commemorate the lives of these people. And then at 3 o'clock, they'll actually, at the Mission de Nombre de Dios, there'll be a unveiling of the historic marker, a permanent marker to identify this as the place where these Africans arrived. And that will be include representatives from the National Park Service. A choir is coming from Tallahassee. There'll be other speakers, as well as the placement of flowers in a basket to honor the 55 nations of Africa and those ancestors who came, who survived, and those who did not.
And Ann Chin, this is similar to other ceremonies that have happened in other Eastern Seaboard communities up and down the coast, correct?
Yes, yes. There are four components that we recommend. The final decisions about what the ceremonies look like, what the markers look like, ultimately belong with the local community. And St. Augustine is in particular unique. Number one, as they're celebrating their 450th, there were Africans who arrived with the Spanish. We always have this idea that Africans came later, as colonies were trying to develop themselves economically. For Florida in particular, Africans were on those ships that came with Pedro Menendez de Aviles.
And in fact, the first record of Africans coming ashore in St. Augustine on Spanish ships, 1565, is that right?
Yes, into St. Augustine. However, if you're talking Ponce de Leon, he had Africans with him. And these people are free and enslaved. So there's a variance of status, and that continues through Florida. There's this back and forth. And all of that will be recorded on the marker. It's not a clean and easy story. It's very complex. Our concern is that, and I always say this jokingly, that St. Augustine's history has been presented sort of in a Flagler Disney style, so that it's Spanish, it may be British, but there are components that are left out, particularly the African and the Native American.
There's so much more to the story, and this is one way to bring that to light. So for people just tuning in, where can they go to Saturday afternoon? Where exactly is the marker going to be placed?
The mission grounds near the Guadalupe marker that is there.
And where's that?
Close to the cross. It's close to the
cross. By the big cross.
By
sure.
the big cross. Yeah.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Everyone knows where that is.
Mm-hmm. Right. If you're coming in, it's toward the right of the cross.
An important event Saturday in St. Augustine, the Middle Passage Project, a special ceremony in the unveiling of an historic marker. And so, ladies, thank you so much for joining us with this preview, and kudos on this excellent work. You can go to the middlepassageproject.org to learn more. Joined by Ann Chin and Ann Cobb this morning. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And just ahead, the economic lessons hidden inside the long-running show The Simpsons. That's next.
WJCTNews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTNews.org. Your community, your world, your news.
It's been 20 years since network television has had an Asian-American sitcom. What do you think? Long enough?
If we can prove that we do have an audience and people that will watch us, it'll hopefully start the ball rolling in terms of finding that Asians can carry a show.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the new ABC series Fresh Off the Boat, next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
It's one of the most dangerous jobs in America.
The worst it was when I tried to pick up a glass of water and I couldn't.
With more back and arm injuries than those suffered by police or construction workers.
The injuries are so severe that many people, their career ending.
We look at the risks of nursing today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekdays at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Well, finally, this hour, it's a unique look at the irrational side of economics using none other than Homer Simpson. Yeah, this week, FSCJ will host speaker and researcher Jody Beggs. Beggs, who hails from Northeastern University, is going to use the long-running show The Simpsons to make the audience laugh, but also teach about behavioral economics. And you might even pick up some money-saving and money-making tips along the way. We've got a preview right now as Jody Beggs joins us by phone. Jody, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. This is fascinating. I've heard of Freakonomics, but not Simpsonomics. Can you give us a window into your talk at FSCJ? How does The Simpsons teach us about the economy?
So one thing that I noticed is because this show has been running for so long, and it's actually really meant to reflect a lot of things that typical people and typical households go through in life, it's not entirely surprising that a lot of what the show depicts actually illustrates a lot of economic concepts, because economics really is about, you know, allocating resources both within companies but within households. It encompasses decision-making and things that really touch on a lot of aspects of our lives. So, of course, that would creep into the narrative of the show a little bit.
So can you give me an example from The Simpsons that kind of illustrates that point?
So my favorite example is a really basic one, because one of the basic concepts of economics is about trade. And there's a scene where Homer Simpson's looking under the couch for a peanut, and he finds $20 instead. And originally, he's disappointed, and he says, oh, $20, but I wanted a peanut. And then his brain goes, wait, $20 can buy many peanuts. And then he goes, explain how. I said, well, money can be exchanged for goods and services, which is one of the really basic concepts in economics, of course. But, you know, even starting at that point and at that level, in a humorous way, the show is pointing out things that should be obvious to us, but sometimes just isn't.
How did you hit upon this idea?
I have a really good editor. The main editor for the project is a professor named Joshua Hall, who had written a paper and actually gotten it published in an academic journal. It gave sort of an overview of a few of these examples. And then he got a contract with a publisher to expand this into an entire book. So he enlisted academics in various fields to each come in and write one chapter about their particular field of expertise.
Interesting. And one of the hooks to this talk is the audience, you're saying, might even get rich along the way, all by studying the wisdom of Homer Simpson. How does that, how will you go about explaining that aspect?
So, you know, getting rich might be a little bit of an understatement, but one of the things that behavioral economics looks at is all the ways in which people are biased in their decision-making, meaning that they make choices that are not actually in their long-term best interest. So in the sense that in some cases, if you know that you're doing something wrong, you can learn to stop doing that wrong thing. So learning about behavioral economics can be important in those ways. To the degree that you can stop making those mistakes, then you will be better off in the long term.
What would be some of the most common mistakes we all make when it comes to our money?
One of the things that we do is we tend to look in a very short-term sense, even when we're looking to invest for retirement or something that has a very long time horizon. We're just naturally conditioned to think about quarterly returns, yearly returns, things like that. And sometimes when we look at our investment portfolio and the size of that, you know, pile of money for retirement, basically, too often those temporary ups and downs look really, really scary. And what ends up happening is it turns us off from what would be in the long-term profit-maximizing behaviors, because looking at the portfolio every day and you say, oh my goodness, it went down by 2% or whatever, seems terrifying. And if we could actually just put the money away, force ourselves to not look at it, we would actually be a lot better off. So we would be less biased in our decision-making. Unfortunately, things like having to file taxes, getting the quarterly reports from our brokerage, et cetera, makes that a little bit hard to do.
Sure. It's like eating our vegetables, right? And you are a serious academic. You've studied at Harvard, MIT. You're the assistant director of research and a lecturer at Northeastern. But you're really, and those are very serious institutions of higher learning, but you're trying to make this kind of fun, right?
Because I think it is. Even when you're teaching upper-level classes, you know, my day job is teaching a master's and PhD-level macroeconomics course. And I feel like even at that level, there's always an opportunity to bring in things to make the material more intuitive for people related to things that they're thinking about anyway. I think that, you know, there's a lot more of those opportunities than we necessarily take advantage of, and that can be used at basically any level to give people a reason to want to pay attention.
Last thought, what's your final takeaway tip for people listening right now that might not be able to come out to your event at FSCJ tomorrow night?
I think that one of the things that we can learn to do is, behavioral economists talk a lot about procrastination, and obviously we all procrastinate, but what the models that economists develop suggest is that we can mitigate procrastination by at least being self-aware about our procrastination. So rather than fool ourselves and say, oh, I'm going to eat my vegetables tomorrow and like really believe that, to at least get to a point where we can say, all right, I don't want to eat my vegetables today, but I also know when tomorrow comes around, I'm not going to want to do it tomorrow, so I might as well do it today. That level of self-awareness can actually help us overcome procrastination.
Interesting. Well, it's fascinating to speak with you. Thanks for jumping on the phone with us, and enjoy your visit to Jacksonville. We appreciate your time.
And one other thing, anybody who is interested in coming, the event is open to the public, and if they need more information, they can get it via my website, economistsdoitwithmodels.com.
That's a great website. Thanks, Jody. We appreciate you being on the show.
You're very welcome. Have a good day.
She's Jody Beggs, speaking at the FSCJ Kent campus tomorrow night. That's going to be a good one. That's our program. Thanks so much for tuning in. And thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our show's producer is Sean Birch. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you've got questions or comments about First Coast Connect, just send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our daily podcast. It's now up on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, the U.S. weighs sending anti-tank missiles and small arms to help Ukraine fight pro-Russian rebels. Both sides say they're calling up more troops. Diane will explore the conflict in Ukraine and the implications of a U.S. move to provide weapons. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.